deformed men among them. Leaning out a bit, I made out the tall, heavy-set figure of Mr. Webb, and a shorter man beside him. This shorter man was strolling along the line of cannon, hands folded beneath his coat-tails, and the Marines, or whatever they were saluting him. At a guess, this was the governor then, Josiah Martin. I watched for a little while, but nothing of interest happened, and I found myself overwhelmed with sudden sleepiness, borne down by the strains of the last month, and the hot, still air that seemed to press upon me like a hand. I lay down on the cot in my borrowed shift and fell instantly asleep. I slept until the middle of the night, when I was again called to attend Mrs. Martin, who seemed to be having a relapse of her digestive difficulties. A slightly pudgy, long-nosed man in nightshirt and cap lurked in the doorway with a candle, looking worried. I took this to be the governor. He looked hard at me, but made no move to interfere, and I had no time to take much notice of him. By the time the crisis had passed, the governor, if indeed it was he, had disappeared. The patient now safely asleep, I lay down like a dog on the rug beside her bed, with a rolled-up petticoat as pillow, and went thankfully back to sleep. It was full daylight when I woke again, and the fire was out. Mrs. Martin was out of bed, calling fretfully into the passage for Dillman. "Wretched girl," she said, turning back as I got awkwardly to my feet. "Got the ague, I suppose, like the rest. I'll run away." I gathered that while several servants were down with the fever, a good many of the others had simply decamped out of fear of contagion. "You're quite sure I haven't got the tertian ague, Mrs. Fraser?" Mrs. Martin squinted at herself in her looking-glass, putting out her tongue and surveying it critically. "I do believe I look yellow." In fact, her complexion was a soft English pink, though rather pale from throwing up. "Keep off the cream cakes and oyster pie in hot weather. Don't eat anything larger than your head at one sitting." "And you should be quite all right," I said, suppressing a yawn. I caught a look at myself in the glass over her shoulder and shuddered. I was nearly as pale as she was, with dark circles under my eyes. And my hair! Well, it was almost clean. That was all that could be said for it. "I should be let blood," Mrs. Martin declared. "That is the proper treatment for a plethory. Dear Dr. Sibelius always said so. 3 or 4 ounces, perhaps, to be followed by the black draught. Dr. Sibelius says he finds the black draught answer very well in such cases." She moved to an armchair and reclined, her belly bulging under her wrapper. She pulled up the sleeve of the wrapper, extending her arm in languorous fashion. "There's a fleam and bowl in the top left drawer, Mrs. Fraser, if you would oblige me." The mere thought of letting blood first thing in the morning was enough to make me want to vomit. As for Dr. Sibelius's black draught, that was laudanum, an alcoholic tincture of opium, and not my treatment of choice for a pregnant woman. The subsequent acrimonious discussion over the virtues of bloodletting, and I began to think, from the anticipatory gleam in her eye, that the thrill of having a vein opened by a murderess was what she actually desired, was interrupted by the unceremonious entry of Mr. Webb. "Do I disturb you, Mum? My apologies." He bowed perfunctorily to Mrs. Martin, then turned to me. "You, put on your cap and come with me." I did so without protest, leaving Mrs. Martin indignantly unperforated. Webb ushered me down the gleamingly polished front stair this time, and into a large, gracious, book-lined room. The governor, now properly wigged, powdered, and elegantly suited, was seated behind a desk overflowing with papers, dockets, scattered quills, blotters, sand-shakers, sealing wax, and all the other impedimenta of an 18th-century bureaucrat. He looked hot, bothered, and quite as indignant as his wife. "What, Webb?" he demanded, scowling at me. "I need a secretary, and you bring me a midwife." "She's a forger," Webb said baldly. That stopped whatever complaint the governor had been going to bring forth. He paused, mouth slightly open, still frowning at me. "Oh," he said in an altered tone, Indeed. Accused of forgery, I said politely. I haven't been tried, let alone convicted, you know.
The governor's eyebrows went up, hearing my educated accent.
Indeed, he said again, more slowly.
He looked me up and down, squinting dubiously. Where on earth did you get her, Webb?
From the jail.
Webb cast me an indifferent glance, as though I might be some unprepossessing yet useful bit of furniture, like a chamber pot.
When I made inquiries for a midwife, someone told me that this woman had done prodigies with a slave, another prisoner having a difficult lying in. And as the matter was urgent and no other cunning woman to be found,
he shrugged with a faint grimace. The governor pulled a handkerchief from his sleeve and dabbed thoughtfully at the plump flesh beneath his chin.
Can you write a fair hand?
I suppose it would be a poor forger who couldn't, but contented myself with saying, yes. Fortunately, it was true. In my own time, I had scribbled ballpoint prescriptions with the best of them, but now I had trained myself to write clearly with a quill, so that my medical records and case notes should be legible for the benefit of whoever should read them after me. Once again, I felt a sharp pang at the thought of Malva, but there was no time to think of her. Still eyeing me speculatively, the governor nodded toward a straight-backed chair and a smaller desk at the side of the room.
Sit.
He rose, scrabbled among the papers on his desk, and deposited one in front of me.
Let me see you make a fair copy of that, if you please.
It was a brief letter to the Royal Council, outlining the governor's concerns regarding recent threats to that body, and postponing the next scheduled meeting of the council. I chose a quill from the cut-glass holder on the desk, found a silver penknife by it, trimmed the quill to my liking, uncorked the inkwell, and set about the business, deeply aware of the scrutiny of the two men. I didn't know how long my imposture might hold up. Mrs. Governor could blow the gaff at any time, but for the nonce, I thought, I probably had a better chance of escape as an accused forger than as an accused murderer. The governor took my finished copy, surveyed it, and laid it on the desk with a small grunt of satisfaction.
"Good enough," he said. "Make 8 further copies of that, and then you can go on with ease."
Turning back to his own desk, he shuffled together a large sheaf of correspondence which he deposited in front of me. The two men, I had no notion of Webb's office, but he was obviously the governor's close friend, returned to a discussion of current business, ignoring me completely. I went about my assigned task mechanically, finding the scratch of the quill, the ritual of sanding, blotting, shaking, soothing. Copying occupied a very small part of my mind. The rest was free to worry about Jamie, and to think how best to engineer an escape. I could, and doubtless should, make an excuse after a bit to go and see how Mrs. Martin did. If I could make shift to do so unaccompanied, I would have a few moments of unobserved freedom, during which to make a surreptitious dash for the nearest exit. So far, though, every door I'd seen had been guarded. The governor's palace had a very well-stocked simples closet. Alas, it would be hard to invent a need for anything from an apothecary, and even then unlikely that they'd let me go alone to fetch it. Waiting for nightfall seemed the best notion. At least, if I did get out of the palace, I would have several hours before my absence was noted. If they locked me in again, though. I scratched away assiduously, turning over various unsatisfactory plans, and trying very hard not to envision Jamie's body turning slowly in the wind, hanging from a tree in some lonely hollow. Christie had given me his word. I clung to that, having nothing else to cling to. Webb and the governor murmured together, but their talk was of things I had no notion of, and for the most part it washed over me like the sound of the sea, meaningless and soothing. After some time, though, Webb came over to instruct me in the sealing and direction of those letters to be sent. I thought of asking why he didn't lend a hand himself in this clerical emergency. but then saw his hands, both badly twisted with arthritis.
"You write a very fair hand, Mrs. Fraser,"
he unbent enough to say at one point, and gave me a brief wintry smile.
"It is unfortunate that you should have been the forger, rather than the murderess."
"Why?" I asked, rather astonished at that.
"Why, you are plainly literate," he said, surprised in turn at my astonishment. "If convicted of murder, you could plead benefit of clergy, and be let off with a public whipping and branding in the face. Forgery, though."
He shook his head, pursing his lips.
"Capital crime, no pardon possible. If convicted of forgery, Mrs. Fraser, I'm afraid you must be hanged."
My feelings of gratitude towards Sadie Ferguson underwent an abrupt reappraisal. "Indeed," I said, as coolly as possible, though my heart had given a convulsive leap and was now trying to burrow out of my chest. "Well, we'll hope that justice is served then, and I am released, won't we?" He made a choked sound that I thought passed for a laugh.
"To be sure, if only for the governor's sake."
After that, we resumed work silently. The gilded clock behind me struck noon, and as though summoned by the sound, a servant, whom I took to be the butler, came in to inquire whether the governor would receive a delegation of the town's citizens. The governor's mouth compressed a bit, but he nodded in resignation, and a group of six or seven men came in, all attired in their best coats, but plainly tradesmen rather than merchants or lawyers. None I recognised, thank God.
"We have come, sir," said one, who introduced himself as George Herbert, "to ask the meaning of this movement of the cannon."
Webb, sitting next to me, stiffened a little, but the governor seemed to have been prepared for this.
"The cannon?" he said, with every evidence of innocent surprise. "Why, the mountings are being repaired. We shall fire a royal salute, as usual, in honour of the Queen's birthday, later in the month." Upon inspecting the cannon in anticipation of this, though, it was discovered that the wood of the caissons had rotted away in spots. Firing the cannon is, of course, impossible until repairs shall be effected. Would you wish to inspect the mountings for yourself, sir?"
He half rose from his seat as he said this, as though personally to escort them outside, but spoke with such a tinge of irony to his courtesy that they flushed and muttered refusals. There was a bit more back and forth in the name of courtesy, but the delegation then left, exhibiting only marginally less suspicion than that with which they'd come in. Webb closed his eyes and exhaled audibly as the door closed behind them.
"God damn them," said the governor, very softly.
I didn't think he meant it to be heard, and pretended I hadn't, busying myself with the papers and keeping my head lowered. Webb got up and went to the window that overlooked the lawn, presumably to assure himself that the cannon were where he thought they should be. By craning a bit, I could see past him. Sure enough, the six cannon had been removed from their mountings and lay on the grass, harmless logs of bronze.
From the subsequent conversation, salted with strong remarks regarding rebellious dogs who had the temerity to put the question to a royal governor as though he were a bootblack, by God,
I gathered that, in fact, the cannon had been removed because of a very real fear that the townspeople might seize them and turn them upon the palace itself. It dawned on me, listening to all this, that things had gone further and moved faster than I had expected. It was mid-July, but of 1775, nearly a year before a larger and more forceful version of the Mecklenburg Declaration would flower into an official declaration of independence for the United Colonies. And yet here was a royal governor in obvious fear of open revolt. If what we had seen on our journey south from the ridge hadn't been enough to convince me that war was now upon us, a day spent with Governor Martin left no doubt. I did go up in the afternoon, accompanied by the watchful Webb, alas, to check my patient, and to make inquiries regarding anyone else who might be ill. Mrs. Martin was torpid and low in spirits, complaining of the heat and the pestilential, wretched climate, missing her daughters, and suffering severely from a lack of personal service, having been obliged to brush her own hair in the absence of Dillman, who had vanished. She was, however, in good health, as I was able to report to the governor, who asked me of it upon my return.
"Would she stand a journey, do you think?" he asked, frowning a bit.
I considered for a moment, then nodded. "I think so. She's a bit wobbly still, from the digestive upset, but she should be quite well again by tomorrow. I see no difficulties with the pregnancy. Tell me, had she any trouble with previous confinements?"
The governor's face flushed rosily at that, but he shook his head. "I thank you, Mrs. Fraser," he said, with a slight inclination of the head. "You will excuse me, George. I must go and speak to Betsy."
"Is he thinking of sending his wife away?" I asked Webb, in the wake of the governor's departure. Despite the heat, a small qualm of uneasiness stirred beneath my skin. For once, Webb seemed quite human. He was frowning after the governor and nodded absently.
"He has family in New York and New Jersey. She'll be safe there with the girls. Her three daughters," he explained, catching my eye.
"Three? She said she'd had six."
"Ah."
I stopped abruptly. "She said she had borne six children, not that she had six living children."
"They have lost three small sons to the fever here," Webb said, still looking after his friend.
He shook his head, sighing.
"It hasn't been a fortunate place for them."
He seemed then to recover himself, and the man disappeared back behind the mask of the chilly bureaucrat. He handed me another sheaf of papers and went out, not bothering to bow. Chapter 93, in which I impersonate a lady. I ate supper alone in my room. The cook seemed still to be functioning, at least, though the atmosphere of disorder in the house was a palpable thing. I could feel the uneasiness, bordering on panic, and had the thought that it wasn't fear of fever or ague that had caused the servants to leave, but more likely that sense of self-preservation that causes rats to flee a sinking ship. From my tiny window, I could see a small portion of the town, apparently serene in the gathering twilight. The light was very different here from that in the mountains, a flat, dimensionless light that limned the houses and the fishing boats in the harbour with a hard-edged clarity, but faded into a haze that hid the farther shore completely, so that I looked beyond the immediate prospect into featureless infinity. I shook off the notion and took from my pocket the ink, quill and paper I had abstracted from the library earlier. I had no idea whether or how I might get a note out of the palace, but I did have a little money still, and if the opportunity offered. I wrote quickly to Fergus and Massali, telling them briefly what had happened, urging Fergus to make inquiries for Jamie in Brunswick and Wilmington. I thought myself that if Jamie was alive, that he was most likely in the Wilmington jail. Brunswick was a tiny settlement dominated by the looming presence of the log-built Fort Johnston, but the fort was a militia garrison. There would be no good reason to take Jamie there, though if they had. The fort was under the command of a Captain Collet, a Swiss emigrant, who knew him. At least he would be safe there. Who else did he know? He had a good many acquaintances on the coast from the days of the regulation. John Ash, for one. They had marched side by side to Alamans, and Ash's company had camped next to ours every night. We had entertained him at our campfire many times. And Ash was from Wilmington. I just finished a brief plea to John Ash when I heard footsteps coming down the hallway toward my room. I folded it hastily, not worrying about smearing, and thrust it with the other note into my pocket. There was no time to do anything with a contraband ink and paper, save push it under the bed. It was Webb, of course, my customary jailer. Evidently, I was now considered the general dog's body of the establishment. I was escorted to Mrs. Martin's room and desired to pack her things. I might have expected complaint or hysteria, but in fact, she was not only dressed, but pale-faced and composed, directing, and even assisting the process with a sense of clear-minded order. The reason for her self-possession was the governor, who came in midway through the packing, his face drawn with worry. She went at once to him and put her hands affectionately on his shoulders.
"Poor Joe," she said softly.
"Have you had any supper?"
"No. It doesn't matter. I'll have a bite later."
He kissed her briefly on the forehead, his look of worry lightening a little as he looked at her.
"You're quite well now, Betsy. You're sure of it?"
I realized suddenly that he was Irish.
Anglo-Irish, at least.
He had no hint of an accent, but his unguarded speech held a faint lilt.
"Entirely recovered," she assured him.
She took his hand and pressed it to her bulge, smiling.
"See how he kicks?"
He smiled back, raised her hand to his lips, and kissed it.
"I'll miss you, darling," she said very softly. "You will take very great care."
He blinked rapidly and looked down, swallowing.
"Of course," he said gruffly. "Dear Betsy, you know I could not bear to part with you unless..."
"I do know. That's why I fear so greatly for you, I..." At this point she looked up and realized suddenly that I was there.
"Mrs. Fraser," she said, in quite a different tone, "go down to the kitchen, please, and have a tray prepared for the governor. You may take it to the library."
I bobbed slightly and went.
Was this the chance I'd been waiting for?
The halls and stairway were deserted, lit only by flickering tin sconces, burning fish oil by the smell. The brick-walled kitchen was, of course, in the basement, and the eerie silence in what should ordinarily be a hive of activity made the unlighted kitchen stairway seem like the descent into a dungeon. There was no light in the kitchen now, save the hearth-fire burning low, but it was burning. Three servants clustered near it despite the smothering heat. They turned at my footsteps, startled and faceless in silhouette. With steam rising from the cauldron behind them, I had the momentary delusion that I was facing Macbeth's three witches, met in dreadful prophecy.
"Double, double, toil and trouble," I said pleasantly,
though my heart beat a little faster as I approached them.
"Fire burn and cauldron bubble."
"Toil and trouble, that be right,"
said a soft female voice, and laughed.
Closer now, I could see that they had appeared faceless in the shadows because they were all black. Slaves, likely, and thus unable to flee the house.
Unable also to carry a message for me. Still, it never hurt to be friendly, and I smiled at them. They smiled shyly back, looking at me with curiosity. I hadn't seen any of them before, nor they me, though downstairs being what it was, I thought it likely they knew who I was.
"Governor be sending his lady away?"
asked the one who had laughed, moving to fetch down a tray from the shelf in response to my request for something light.
"Yes," I said.
I realized the value of gossip as currency, and related everything that I decently could, as the three of them moved efficiently about, dark as shadows, their darting hands slicing, spreading, arranging. Molly, the cook, shook her head, her white cap like a sunset cloud in the fire's glow.
"Bad times, bad times," she said, clicking her tongue,
and the other two murmured assent. I thought, from their attitude, that they liked the governor, but then, as slaves, their fate was inextricably linked with his, regardless of their feelings. It occurred to me, as we chatted, that even if they couldn't reasonably flee the house altogether, they might at least leave the premises now and again. Someone had to do the marketing, and there seemed to be no one else left. In fact, this proved to be the case. Suki, the one who had laughed, went out to buy fish and fresh vegetables in the mornings, and, tactfully approached, wasn't averse to delivering my notes to the print shop. She said she knew where it was, the place with all the books in the window, for a small consideration. She tucked away the paper and money in her bosom, giving me a knowing look, and winked. God knew what she thought it was, but I winked back, and hefting the loaded tray, made my way back up into the fishy-smelling realms of light. I found the governor alone in the library, burning papers.
He nodded absently at the tray I set on the desk, but didn't touch it. I wasn't sure what to do, and after a moment's awkward standing about, sat down at my accustomed place. The governor thrust a final sheaf of documents into the fire, then stood looking bleakly after them as they blackened and curled. The room had cooled a little with the setting sun, but the windows were tightly shut, of course, and rivulets of condensing moisture rolled down the ornamental panes of glass. Blotting a similar condensation from my cheeks and nose, I got up and threw open the window closest to me, drawing in a deep gulp of the evening air, cloyingly warm, but fresh and sweet with honeysuckle and roses from the garden, undercut with dankness from the distant shore. Wood smoke, too. There were fires burning outside. The soldiers who guarded the palace had watch fires burning, evenly spaced around the perimeter of the grounds. Well, that would help with the mosquitoes, and we wouldn't be completely surprised if an attack should come. The governor came to stand behind me. I expected him to tell me to shut the window, but he merely stood, looking out across his lawns and the long, gravelled drive. The moon had risen, and the dismounted cannon were dimly visible, lying in the shadows like dead men in a row. After a moment, the governor moved back to his desk, and calling me over, handed me a sheaf of official correspondence for copying, another for sorting and filing. He left the window open. I thought that he wished to hear if anything should happen. I wondered where the omnipresent web was. There was no sound from elsewhere in the palace. Presumably Mrs. Martin had finished her packing alone and gone to bed. We worked on through the intermittent chiming of the clock, the governor getting up now and then to commit another batch of papers to the fire, taking my copies and bundling them into large leather folders that he bound with tape, stacking them on his desk. He had taken off his wig. His hair was brown, short but curly, rather like my own had been after the fever. Now and then he paused, head turned, listening. I had faced a mob and knew what he was listening for. I didn't know what to hope for at this point or to fear. And so I worked on, welcoming the work for the numbing distraction it was, though my hand had grown desperately cramped, and I had to pause every few moments to rub it. The governor was writing now. He shifted in his chair, grimacing with discomfort in spite of the cushion. Mrs. Martin had told me that he suffered from a fistula. I doubted very much that he'd let me treat it. He eased himself onto one buttock and rubbed a hand down his face. It was late, and he was plainly tired as well as uncomfortable. I was tired, too, stifling yawns that threatened to dislocate my jaw and left my eyes watering. He kept doggedly working, though, with occasional glances at the door. Who was he expecting? The window at my back was still open, and the soft air caressed me, warm as blood, but moving enough to stir the wisps of hair on my neck and make the candle flame waver wildly. It bent to one side and flickered as though it would go out, and the governor reached quickly to shelter it with a cupped hand. The breeze passed, and the air fell still again, save for the sound of crickets outside. The governor's attention seemed focused on the paper before him, but suddenly his head turned sharply as though he had seen something dart past the open door. He looked for a moment, then blinked, rubbed his eyes, and returned his attention to the paper. But he couldn't keep it there. He glanced again at the empty doorway. I couldn't help looking too. Then back, blinking.
"Did you see someone pass, Mrs. Fraser?" he asked.
"No, sir,"
I said, nobly swallowing a yawn.
"Ah."
Seeming somehow disappointed, he took up his quill but didn't write anything, just held it between his fingers as though he had forgotten it was there. "Were you expecting anyone, Your Excellency?" I asked politely, and his head jerked up, surprised to be directly addressed.
"Oh, no. That is..."
His voice died away as he glanced once more at the doorway that led to the back of the house.
"My son," he said. "Our darling Sam. He Died here, you know. Late last year. Only 8 years old. Sometimes, I think I see him, he ended quietly, and bent his head once more over his paper, lips pressed tight. I moved impulsively, meaning to touch his hand, but his tight-lipped air prevented me. I am sorry, I said quietly instead. He didn't speak, but gave one quick, short nod of acknowledgement, not raising his head. His lips tightened further, and he went back to his writing, as did I. A little later, the clock struck the hour, then two. It had a soft, sweet chime, and the governor stopped to listen, a distant look in his eyes.
So late, he said, as the last chime died away. I have kept you intolerably late, Mrs. Fraser. Forgive me.
He motioned to me to leave the papers I was working on, and I rose, stiff and aching from sitting so long. I shook my skirts into some order and turned to go, realizing only then that he had made no move to put away his ink and quills.
You should go to bed too, you know, I said to him, turning and pausing at the door.
The palace was still. Even the crickets had ceased, and only the soft snore of a sleeping soldier in the hall disturbed the quiet.
Yes, he said,
and gave me a small, tired smile.
Soon.
He shifted his weight to the other buttock and picked up his quill, bending his head once more over the papers.
No one woke me in the morning, and the sun was well up when I stirred on my own.
Listening to the silence, I had a momentary fear that everyone had decamped in the night, leaving me locked in to starve. I rose hastily, though, and looked out. The red-coated soldiers were still patrolling the grounds, just as usual. I could see small groups of citizens outside the perimeter, mostly strolling past in twos or threes, but sometimes stopping to stare at the palace. Then I began to hear small thumps and homely noises on the floor below and felt relieved. I wasn't entirely abandoned. I was, however, extremely hungry by the time the butler came to let me out. He brought me to Mrs. Martin's bedchamber, but to my surprise it was empty. He left me there, and within a few moments, merrily, one of the kitchen slaves came in, looking apprehensive at being in this unfamiliar part of the house.
"Whatever is going on?" I asked her. "Where's Mrs. Martin, do you know?"
"Well, I know that," she said in a dubious tone, indicating that it was the only thing she did know for certain. "She left just afore dawn this morning. That Mr. Webb, he took her away secret-like, in a wagon, with her boxes."
I nodded, perplexed.
It was reasonable that she should have left quietly. I imagine the governor didn't want to give any indication that he felt threatened, for fear of provoking exactly the violence he feared.
"But if Mrs. Martin is gone," I said, "why am I here? Why are you here?"
"Oh, well, I know that too," Merrily said, gaining a bit of confidence. "I's supposed to help you dress, ma'am."
"But I don't need any," I began, and then saw the garments laid out on the bed. One of Mrs. Martin's day gowns, a pretty printed floral cotton done in the newly popular Polonaise fashion, complete with voluminous petticoats, silk stockings, and a large straw hat to shade the face. Evidently I was meant to impersonate the governor's wife. There was no real point in protesting. I could hear the governor and the butler talking in the hall, and after all, if it got me out of the palace, so much the better. I was only 2 or 3 inches taller than Mrs. Martin, and my lack of a bulge made the gown hang lower. There was no hope of my fitting into any of her shoes, but my own were not completely disreputable, in spite of all my adventures since leaving home. Merrily cleaned them and rubbed them with a bit of grease to make the leather shine. They were at least not so crude as to draw attention immediately. With the broad-brimmed hat slanting forward to hide my face, and my hair twisted up and firmly pinned under a cap beneath it, I was probably a reasonable approximation, at least to people who didn't know Mrs. Martin well.
The governor frowned when he saw me, and walked slowly round me, tugging here and there to adjust the fit, but then nodded, and with a small bow, offered me his arm.
"Your servant, ma'am," he said politely.
And with me slumping slightly to disguise my height, we went out the front door to find the governor's carriage waiting in the drive. Chapter 94. Absquatulation. Jamie Fraser observed the quantity and quality of books in the window of the print shop, F. Fraser proprietor, and allowed himself a momentary sense of pride in Fergus. The establishment, though small, was apparently thriving. Time, however, was pressing, and he pushed through the door without stopping to read the titles. A small bell over the door rang at his entrance, and Germaine popped up behind the counter like an ink-smeared jack-in-the-box, emitting a whoop of joy at sight of his grandfather and his uncle Ian. "Grand-père! Grand-père!" he shouted, then dived under the flap in the counter, clutching Jamie about the hips in ecstasy. He'd grown. The top of his head now reached Jamie's lower ribs. Jamie ruffled the shiny blonde hair gently, then detached Germaine and told him to fetch his father. No need. Aroused by the shouting, the whole family came boiling out from the living quarters behind the shop, exclaiming, yelling, squealing, and generally carrying on like a pack of wolves, as Ian pointed out to them. Henri Christian riding on his shoulders in red-faced triumph, clinging to his hair.
"What has happened, milord? Why are you here?"
Fergus disengaged Jamie easily from the riot and drew him aside into the alcove where the more expensive books were kept, and those not suitable for public display. He could see from the look on Fergus's face that some news had come down from the mountains. While surprised to see him, Fergus wasn't astonished, and his pleasure covered a worried mind. He explained the matter as quickly as he could, stumbling now and then over his words from haste and weariness. One of the horses had broken down some 40 miles from town, and unable to find another, they had walked for 2 nights and a day, taking it in turns to ride, the other trotting alongside, clinging to the stirrup leathers. Fergus listened with attention, wiping his mouth with the handkerchief he had taken from his collar. They'd arrived in the middle of dinner.
"The sheriff, that would be Mr. Tolliver," he said.
"I know him. Shall we—"
Jamie made an abrupt gesture, cutting him short.
"We went there to begin with," he said.
They had found the sheriff gone, and no one in the house save a very drunken woman with a face like a discontented bird, collapsed and snoring on the settle with a small negro baby clutched in her arms. He had taken the baby and thrust it into Ian's arms, bidding him grimly to mind it while he sobered the woman enough to talk. He had then dragged her out into the yard and poured buckets of well water over her until she gasped and blinked, then dragged her, dripping and stumbling, back into the house, where he obliged her to drink water poured over the black, burned dregs of chicory coffee he had found in the pot. She had vomited profusely and disgustingly, but regained some vague sense of language.
At first, all she could see was that all of the female prisoners were gone, run off or hanged.
He said nothing of the fright that had lanced through his belly at that last. He had shaken the woman thoroughly, though, demanding particulars, and eventually, after further applications of water and vile coffee, got them.
"A man came the day before yesterday and took her away. That's all she knew, or all she remembered. I made her tell me what she could of how he looked. It wasn't a Brown, nor yet Neil Forbes."
"I see."
Fergus glanced behind him. His family were all gathered round Ian, pestering and caressing him. Massali, though, was looking toward the alcove, worry on her face, obviously wanting to come and join the conversation, but detained by Joan, who was tugging on her skirt.
"Who would take her, I wonder?"
"Junie, Acushler, will you not leave go? Help Felicite for a moment, aye?"
"But, Mama—"
"Not now. In a moment, aye?"
"I dinna ken," Jamie said,
the frustration of helplessness welling up like black bile at the back of his throat. A sudden, more horrible thought struck him.
Good. Do you suppose it might have been Stephen Bonnet?
The woman's slurred description hadn't sounded like the pirate, but she had been far from certain in it. Could Forbes have learned of his own escape and determined simply to reverse the roles in the drama he had conceived, deport Claire forcibly to England, and try to pin the guilt of Mulva Christie's death to Jamie's coat? He found it hard to breathe and had to force air into his chest. If Forbes had given Claire to Bonnet, he would slit the lawyer from wishbone to cock, rip the guts from his belly, and strangle him with them. And the same for the Irishman, once he laid hands upon him.
Puppy! Puppy!
Joan's sing-song voice penetrated dimly through the red cloud that filled his head.
What, Sherry?
Fergus lifted her with the ease of long practice, balancing her fat little bottom on his left arm to leave his right hand free. She put her arms round his neck and hissed something into his ear.
Oh, did you?
He said, plainly abstracted. Très bien.
Where did you put it, Sherry?
With the naughty lady pictures.
She pointed at the upper shelf, where several volumes lay, leather-bound, but discreetly untitled. Glancing in the direction she indicated, Jamie saw a smudged paper sticking out from between two of the books. Fergus clicked his tongue in displeasure and smacked her lightly on the bottom with his good hand.
You know you're not to climb up there.
Jamie reached over and pulled the paper out, and felt all the blood leave his head at sight of the familiar writing on it.
What?
Fergus, alarmed at his appearance, set Joanie down.
Sit, milor. Run, Sherry. Get the smelling bottle.
Jamie waved a hand, speechless, trying to indicate that he was all right, and succeeded at last in finding his tongue.
She's in the governor's palace, he said. Christ be thanked, she's safe.
Seeing a stool pushed under the shelf, he pulled it out and sat on it, feeling exhaustion pulse through the quivering muscles of thigh and calf, ignoring the confusion of questions and explanations. How Joanie had found the note pushed under the door. Anonymous submissions to the newspaper often were delivered in this fashion, and the children knew they were to bring such things to their father's attention. Fergus read the note, his dark eyes assuming the expression of interested intent that he always had when contemplating the abstraction of something difficult and valuable.
"Well, that is good," he said. "We will go and fetch her. But I think first you must eat a little, milor."
He wished to refuse, to say that there wasn't a moment to be lost, that he could eat nothing in any case. His whim was knotted, hurting him. But Marsali was already hurrying the girls back to the kitchen, calling out things about hot coffee and bread, and Ian following her, Henri Christian still wrapped lovingly about his ears, Germain yapping eagerly at his heels. And he knew that, should it come to a fight, he had nothing left to fight with. Then the succulent sizzle and scent of eggs frying in butter reached him, and he was up and moving toward the back, like iron drawn by a magnet. Over their hasty meal, various plans were offered and rejected. At length, he reluctantly accepted Fergus's suggestion that either Fergus or Ian should go openly to the palace, asking to see Claire, saying that he was a kinsman wishing to assure himself of her welfare.
"They have no reason to deny her presence after all," Fergus said, shrugging. "If we can see her, so much the better. But even if not, we will learn whether she is still there, and perhaps where she is likely to be within the palace."
Fergus clearly wished to undertake the errand, but yielded when Ian pointed out that Fergus was widely known in New Bern, and it might be suspected that he was merely hunting scandal for the newspaper.
"For I am pained to say, milor," Fergus said apologetically, "that the matter, the crime, is known here already. There are broadsheets, the usual nonsense. Longuyon was obliged to print something regarding the matter, of course, to keep our countenance. But we did so in a most repressive fashion, mentioning only the bald facts of the matter."
His long, mobile mouth compressed briefly, in illustration of the repressive nature of his article, And Jamie smiled faintly.
Aye, I see, he said.
He pushed back from the table, pleased to feel some strength return to his limbs, and heartened anew by food, coffee, and the comforting knowledge of Claire's whereabouts.
Well then, Ian, comb your hair. You didn't want the governor to think you're savage.
Jamie insisted upon going with Ian, despite the danger of being recognised. His nephew eyed him narrowly.
You're not going to do anything foolish, Uncle Jimmy. When was the last time you kent me to do anything foolish?
Ian gave him an old-fashioned look, held up one hand, and began to fold the fingers down one by one.
Oh, well, let me reckon then. Sims the printer? Tarring forms? Roger Mack told me what you did in Mecklenburg. And then there was... You would have let them kill wee Fogarty? Jamie inquired. And if we're mentioning fools, who was it got his ass pricked for wallowing in mortal sin with, "What I mean is," Ian said severely, "you're not going to walk into the governor's palace and try to take her by force, no matter what happens. You'll wait quietly, wee your hat on, until I come back, and then we'll see, aye?"
Jamie pulled down the brim of his hat, a floppy, weathered felt affair, such as a pig farmer might wear, with his hair tucked up beneath it.
"What makes you think I wouldn't?"
he asked, as much from curiosity as natural contention.
"The look on your face," Ian replied briefly. "I want her back as much as you do, Uncle Jamie."
"Well," he amended, with a wry grin, "perhaps not quite so much.
But I mean to have her back, nonetheless. You,"
he poked his uncle emphatically in the chest,
"bide your time."
And leaving Jamie standing under a heat-stricken elm, he strode purposefully toward the gates of the palace. Jamie took several deep breaths, trying to maintain a sense of annoyance with Ian as an antidote to the anxiety that wrapped itself round his chest like a snake. As the annoyance had been purely manufactured, it evaporated like steam from a kettle, leaving the anxiety squirming and writhing. Ian had reached the gate and was in palaver with the guard who stood there, musket at the ready. Jamie could see the man shaking his head emphatically.
This was nonsense, he thought.
The need of her was a physical thing, like the thirst of a sailor becalmed for weeks on the sea. He'd felt that need before, often in their years apart. But why now?
She was safe. He knew where she was.
Was it only the exhaustion of the past weeks and days, or perhaps the weakness of creeping age that made his bones ache, as though she had in fact been torn from his body, as God had made Eve from Adam's rib? Ian was arguing, making persuasive gestures toward the guard. The sound of wheels on gravel drew his attention from them. A carriage was coming down the drive, a small open conveyance with two people and a driver, drawn by a team of nice dark bays. The guard had pushed Ian back with the barrel of his musket, gesturing him to keep away while the guard and his fellow opened the gates. The carriage rattled through without stopping, turned into the street, and came past him. He had never seen Josiah Martin, but thought the plump, self-important-looking gentleman must surely be the... His eye caught the merest glimpse of the woman, and his heart clenched like a fist. Without an instant thought, he was pelting after the carriage as hard as he could run. In his prime, he couldn't have outrun a team of horses. But even so, he came within a few feet of the carriage, would have called, but had no breath, no sight, and then his foot struck a misplaced cobble and he fell headlong. He lay stunned and breathless, vision dark and his lungs afire, hearing only the receding clatter of hooves and carriage wheels, until a strong hand seized his arm and jerked.
"We'll avoid notice, he says," Ian muttered, bending to get his shoulder under Jamie's arm. "Your hat's flown off, did you notice that?" "Nay, of course not, nor the whole street staring, you crack-brained gomeral. God, you weigh as much as a 3-year bullock." "Ian," he said, and paused to gulp for breath. "Aye, you sound like your mother. Stop.
Another gulp of air.
And let go my arm. I can walk.
Ian gave a snort that sounded even more like Jenny, but did stop and did let go. Jamie picked up his fallen hat and limped toward the print shop, Ian following in urgent silence through the staring streets. Safely away from the palace, we trotted sedately through the streets of New Bern, provoking only mild interest from the citizenry, some of whom waved, a few of whom called out vaguely hostile things, most of whom simply stared. At the edge of town, the groom turned the team onto the main road, and we bowled pleasantly along, apparently bound for an outing in the countryside, an illusion bolstered by the wicker picnic hamper visible behind us. Once past the congestion of heavy wagons, cattle, sheep, and the other traffic of commerce, though, the groom whipped up, and we were flying again. "Where are we going?" I shouted over the noise of the team, holding onto my hat to prevent it blowing off. I had thought we were merely providing a diversion so that no one would notice Mrs. Martin's quiet removal until she was safely out of the colony. Evidently, though, we were not merely out for a picnic. "Brunswick!" the governor shouted back.
"Where?"
"Brunswick," he repeated.
He looked grim and grimmer still as he cast a last look back toward New Bern.
"God damn them," he said,
though I was sure he meant this observation only for himself. He turned round then and settled himself, leaning slightly forward as though to speed the carriage, and said no more.
Chapter 95. The Cruiser. I woke every morning just before dawn. Worn out from worry and the governor's late hours, I slept like the dead through all the thumps and rattlings and bell ringings of the watch, shouts from boats nearby, occasional musket fire from the shore, and the whine of the offshore wind as it passed through the rigging. But in that moment before the light, the silence woke me. "Today," was the single thought in my head, and I seemed to hang bodiless for a moment, just above my pallet beneath the forecastle. Then I drew breath, heard my heart beating, and felt the gentle heave of the deck beneath me. Would turn my face to the shore, watching, as the light began to touch the waves and reach toward land. We had first gone to Fort Johnston, but had stayed there barely long enough for the governor to meet with local loyalists who had assured him how unsafe it was, before retreating further. We had been aboard His Majesty's sloop cruiser for nearly a week, anchored off Brunswick. Lacking any troops save the Marines aboard the sloop, Governor Martin was unable to seize back control of his colony and was reduced to writing frenzied letters attempting to keep up some semblance of a government in exile. Lacking anyone else to fill the office, I remained in my role as ad hoc secretary, though I had moved up from mere copyist to amanuensis, taking down some letters by dictation when Martin grew too tired to write himself. And cut off from land and information alike, I spent every spare moment watching the shore. Today, a boat was coming out of the fading dark. One of the watch hailed it, and an answering halloo came up, in tones of such agitation that I sat up abruptly, groping for my stays. Today there would be news. The messenger was already in the governor's cabin, and one of the marines barred my way, but the door was open, and the man's voice clearly audible.
"Ashley's done it, sir. He's moving against the fort. Well, God damn him for a treasonous dog."
There was a sound of footsteps, and the marine stepped hastily out of the way just in time to avoid the governor, who came popping out of his cabin like a jack out of the box, still attired in a billowing nightshirt and minus his wig. He seized the ladder and scampered up it like a monkey, affording me an unwanted view from below of his chubby bare buttocks. The marine caught my eye and quickly averted his own gaze.
"What are they doing? Do you see them?"
"Not yet."
The messenger, a middle-aged man in the dress of a farmer, had followed the governor up the ladder. Their voices floated down from the rail.
"Colonel Ash ordered all the ships in Wilmington Harbour to take on troops yesterday and float them down to Brunswick.
They were mustering just outside the town this morning. I heard the roll calls whilst I was doing the morning milking. Nigh on to 500 men they must have. When I saw that, sir, I slipped away down to the shore and found a boat. Thought you ought to know, Your Excellence.
The man's voice had lost its agitation now, and taken on a rather self-righteous tone.
Oh, yes? And what do you expect me to do about it?
The governor sounded distinctly cranky.
How should I know? Said the messenger, replying in like vein. I ain't the governor now, am I?
The governor's response to this was drowned out by the striking of the ship's bell. As it died away, he strode past the companionway and, looking down, saw me below.
Oh, Mrs. Fraser, will you fetch me some tea from the galley?
I hadn't much choice, though I would have preferred to stay and eavesdrop. The galley fire had been banked for the night in its small iron pot, and the cook was still abed. By the time I had poked up the fire, boiled water, brewed a pot of tea, and assembled a tray with teapot, cup, saucer, milk and toast, butter, biscuits and jam, the governor's informant had gone. I saw his boat heading for the shore, a dark arrowhead against the slowly brightening surface of the sea. I paused for a moment on deck and rested my tea tray on the rail, looking inland. It was just light now, and Fort Johnston was visible, a blocky log building that stood exposed on top of a low rise, surrounded by a cluster of houses and outbuildings. There was a fair amount of activity around it. Men were coming and going like a trail of ants. Nothing that looked like an imminent invasion, though. Either the commander, Captain Colley, had decided to evacuate, or Ash's men had not yet begun their march from Brunswick. Had John Ash received my message? If he had, would he have acted?
It wouldn't have been a popular thing to do.
I couldn't blame him if he had decided that he simply couldn't afford to be seen aiding a man widely suspected of being a loyalist, let alone one accused of such a hideous crime.
He might have, though.
With the governor marooned at sea, the council disbanded, and the court system evaporated, there was no effective law in the colony now, save for the militias. And if Ash chose to storm the Wilmington jail and remove Jamie, he would have faced precious little opposition. And if he had, if Jamie were free, he would be looking for me. And surely he would hear quickly where I was. If John Ash came to Brunswick and Jamie were free, he would surely come with Ash's men. I looked toward shore, seeking movement, but saw only a boy driving a cow desultorily along the road to Brunswick. But the shadows of the night were still cold around my feet. It was barely dawn. I took a deep breath and noticed the aromatic scent of the tea mixed with the shore's morning breath, the smell of tide flats and piney scrub. I hadn't drunk tea in months, if not years. Thoughtfully, I poured a cup and sipped it slowly, watching the shore. When I arrived in the surgeon's cabin, which the governor had taken for his office, he was dressed and alone.
"Mrs. Fraser,"
he nodded briefly to me, scarcely looking up.
"I'm obliged. Will you write, please?"
He'd been writing himself already. Quills and sand and blotter were scattered about the desk, and the inkwell stood open. I picked out a decent quill and a sheet of paper, and began to write as per his dictation, with a sense of growing curiosity. The note, dictated between bites of toast, was to a General Hugh MacDonald, and referred to the General's safe arrival upon the mainland with a Colonel MacLeod. Receipt of the General's report was acknowledged, and request made for continuing information. Mention was also made of the Governor's request for support, which I knew about, and assurances he had received regarding the arrival of that support, which I didn't.
Enclosure? A letter of credit? No. Wait.
The governor darted a look in the direction of the shore, to no particular avail as the surgeon's cabin boasted no porthole, and scowled in concentration. Evidently it had occurred to him that in light of recent events, a letter of credit issued by the governor's office was possibly worth less than one of Mrs. Ferguson's forgeries.
"Enclosure, 20 shillings," he amended with a sigh. "If you will make the fair copy at once, Mrs. Fraser. These you may do at your leisure."
He pushed across an untidy stack of notes, done in his own crabbed hand.
He got up then, groaning as he stretched, and went out,
no doubt to peer over the railing at the fort again. I made the copy, sanded it, and set it aside, wondering who on earth this MacDonald was, and what he was doing.
Unless Major MacDonald had undergone a change of name and an extraordinary promotion of late, it couldn't be he. And from the tone of the Governor's remarks, it appeared that General MacDonald and his friend MacLeod were travelling alone, and on some particular mission.
I flipped quickly through the waiting stack of notes, but saw nothing else of interest, just the usual administrative trivia. The Governor had left his writing desk on the table, but it was closed. I debated trying to pick the lock and rummage through his private correspondence, but there were too many people about. Seamen, marines, ship's boys, visitors. The place was seething. There was a sense of nervous tension aboard as well. I'd noticed many times before how a sense of danger communicates itself among people in the confined setting. Hospital emergency room, surgical suite, train car, ship. Urgency flashes from one person to the next without speech, like the impulse down a neuron's axon to the dendrites of another. I didn't know whether anyone beyond the Governor and myself knew about John Ash's movements yet, but the cruiser knew that something was up. The sense of nervous anticipation was affecting me, too. I was fidgeting, toe-tapping absently, fingers moving restlessly up and down the shaft of the quill, unable to concentrate enough to write with it. I stood up, with no idea what I meant to do, only the fixed notion that I would suffocate with impatience if I stayed below any longer. On the shelf beside the door to the cabin stood the usual half-tidy clutter of shipboard jammed behind a rail. A candlestick, extra candles, a tinderbox, a broken pipe, a bottle with a twist of flax stopping it, a bit of wood that someone had tried to carve and made a mess of, and a box. The cruiser had no surgeon aboard, and surgeons tended to take their personal implements with them, unless they died. This must be a kit belonging to the ship itself. I glanced out the door. There were voices nearby, but no one in sight. I hastily flipped open the box, wrinkling my nose at the scent of dried blood and stale tobacco. There wasn't much there, and what there was thrown in, higgledy-piggledy, rusted, crusted, and of little use. A tin of blue pills, so labelled, and a bottle, not labelled, but recognisable, of black draught. Laudanum, that is. A dried-up sponge, and a sticky cloth stained with something yellow. And the one thing certain to be in any surgeon's kit of the time, blades. There were footsteps coming down the companionway, and I heard the Governor's voice talking to someone. Without pausing to consider the wisdom of my conduct, I grabbed a small jointing knife and thrust it down the front of my stays. I slammed shut the lid of the box. There was no time to sit down again, though, before the Governor arrived, with another visitor in tow. My heart was hammering in my throat. I pressed my palms, damp with sweat, against my skirt, and nodded to the new arrival, who was regarding me open-mouthed behind the Governor. "Major MacDonald," I said, hoping that my voice wouldn't tremble. "Fancy meeting you here." MacDonald's mouth snapped shut, and he drew himself more firmly upright.
"Mrs. Fraser," he said, bowing warily. "Your servant, mum. You know her?"
Governor Martin glanced from MacDonald to me and back, frowning.
"We've met," I said, nodding politely.
It had occurred to me that it might not profit either of us for the Governor to think there was some connection between us, if indeed there was one. The same thought had clearly struck MacDonald. His face betrayed nothing beyond faint courtesy, though I could see the thoughts darting to and fro behind his eyes like a swarm of gnats.
I was entertaining a similar swarm myself, and knowing that my own face was naturally revealing, I cast down my eyes demurely, and, murmuring an excuse about refreshment, made off toward the galley. I threaded my way through clumps of seamen and marines, mechanically acknowledging their salutes, mind working furiously. How? How was I going to speak to MacDonald alone? I had to find out what he knew about Jamie, if anything. Would he tell me if he did know anything? But yes, I thought, he would. Soldier he might be, but MacDonald was also a confirmed gossip, and he was plainly dying of curiosity at the sight of me. The cook, a chubby young free black named Tinsdale, who wore his hair in three stubby braids that stuck out of his head like the horns of a triceratops, was at work in the galley, dreamily toasting bread over the fire. "Oh, hello," he said amiably, seeing me. He waved the toasting fork. "Want a bit of toast, Mrs. Fraser? Or is it the hot water again?" "Love some toast," I said, seized by inspiration. "But the governor has company. He wants coffee sent. And if you have a few of those nice almond biscuits to go with it..." Armed with a loaded coffee tray, I made my way toward the surgeon's cabin a few minutes later, heart pounding. The door was open for air. Evidently, it wasn't a secret meeting. They were huddled together over the small desk, the governor frowning at a wad of papers, these clearly having travelled some distance in MacDonald's dispatch case, judging from the creases and stains upon them. They appeared to be letters, written in a variety of hands and inks.
"Oh, coffee," the governor said, looking up.
He seemed vaguely pleased, plainly not recalling that he hadn't ordered any.
"Splendid. Thank you, Mrs. Fraser."
MacDonald hastily picked up the papers, making room for me to set the tray down on the desk. The governor had one in his hand. He kept hold of this, and I caught a quick glimpse of it as I bent to place the tray in front of him. It was a list of some sort. Names on one side, numbers beside them. I managed to knock a spoon to the floor, enabling a better look as I stooped for it. H. Bethune, Cook's Creek, 14. Jonathan McManus, Boone, 3. F. Campbell, Campbellton, 24? I darted a look at MacDonald, who had his eyes fixed on me. I dropped the spoon on the desk, then took a hasty step back so that I stood directly behind the governor. I pointed a finger at MacDonald, then in rapid succession clutched my throat, tongue protruding, grabbed my stomach with crossed forearms, then jabbed the finger again at him, then at myself, all the while giving a monitory stare. MacDonald viewed this pantomime with subdued fascination, but with a veiled glance at the governor, who was stirring his coffee with one hand, frowning at the paper he held in the other, gave me a tiny nod.
"How many can you be quite sure of?" the governor was saying as I curtsied and backed out. "Oh, at least 500 men, sir, even now," MacDonald replied confidently. "A great many more to come as word spreads. You should see the enthusiasm with which the general has been received so far. I cannot speak for the Germans, of course, but depend upon it, sir, we shall have all the Highlanders of the back country, and not a few of the Scotch-Irish, too." "God knows I hope you are right," the governor said, sounding hopeful but still dubious. "Where's the general now?"
I would have liked to hear the answer to that, and a good many other things, but the drum was beating overhead for mess, and thundering feet were already pounding down the decks and companionways. I couldn't lurk about eavesdropping in plain sight of the mess, so was obliged to go back up top, hoping that MacDonald had indeed got my message. The captain of the cruiser was standing by the rail, his first mate beside him, both scanning the shore with their telescopes. "Is anything happening?" I could see more activity near the fort, people coming and going, but the shore road was still empty.
"Can't say, ma'am."
Captain Follard shook his head, then lowered the telescope and shut it, reluctantly, as though afraid something might happen if he didn't keep his eyes fixed on the shore. The first mate didn't move, still squinting fixedly toward the fort on its bluff. I remained there by his side, staring silently toward the shore. The tide shifted. I had been on the ship long enough to feel it, a barely perceptible pause, the sea taking breath as the invisible moon yielded its pull. There is a tide in the affairs of men. Surely Shakespeare had stood upon a deck at least once and felt that same faint shift deep in the flesh. A professor had told me once in medical school that the Polynesian seafarers dared their vast journeys through the trackless sea because they had learned to sense the currents of the ocean, the shifts of wind and tide, registering these changes with that most delicate of instruments, their testicles. It didn't take a scrotum to feel the currents that were swirling round us now, I reflected, with a sideways glance at the first mate's securely fastened white breeches. I could feel them in the pit of my stomach, in the